podcast commentaries that Ron Moore used to do for the Battlestar Galactica episodes would always lead off with a whether the smoking lamp was lit or not lit that night, and what the scotch was that night. And so, you want to talk about what we're drinking?
Well, I have just finished a Rampart. It's an IPA. Very good, I recommend it. And I'm currently on a water, because if I have another beer, then I'll start singing dirty limericks, and that's not conducive to the podcast.
You guys have a head start.
Are you certain that's not conducive to the podcast?
I said, that could be excellent.
There was a man from Nantucket.
All right. And see. I'm also on a New Belgium one. I'm on a Snapshot, which is a wheat beer with a cool retro camera on the bottle, but I've never had it before, but it's quite tasty.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it when I tried it. I'm also having a Rampant, which is an Imperial IPA with a very hefty alcohol content for an IPA, which I appreciate.
Yep.
And I find it odd, actually, that we're all drinking New Belgium beers, because it usually doesn't work out like that.
No, this is an odd night. So I think it's a New Belgium kind of night. Yeah. New Belgium doesn't have... They don't produce heavy stouts or stuff like that. It's a warm night, and it's
95 degrees, 90% humidity, so it's definitely not a night for anything too heavy.
Yeah, even their dark beer, the 1554, mm-hmm. is a light dark beer.
Yes, so
it's a lager rather than a stout, so it doesn't have the heft.
So we can say without fear of contradiction that tonight's podcast is brought to you by New Belgium Beer, voluntarily or otherwise.
Yes.
Hint, hint, New Belgium.
Please send beer.
When we put together the show notes for the first episode, Mike, you had put on the show. We had just passed VJ Day.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little in the past now, but no time like the present. Would you guys have dropped the bomb?
Yes.
Simon, I'm going to leave this one to you.
Well, yes, for all the boring reasons.
What are your boring reasons?
The people who argue that it was unnecessary, or that it was primarily done to intimidate the Soviet Union rather than to end the war with Japan, are hugely discounting what an invasion would cost. I mean, the problem is that it's always easier to sell peace,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it always sounds rhetorically better, but it tends to discount complex realities. So, for example, earlier today, Pope Francis tweeted... About how war is a terrible thing and an engine of catastrophe in people's lives, and all this kind of spiel that goes back to Paul VI, banging his shoe at the United Nations saying, no war, no war. Yes, I know Khrushchev was the one who banged his shoe. It's an analogy. But anyway, so...
You would prefer that he bang a red shoe.
Yes, exactly. If he banged a red shoe, I'd be just fine with it. But the... red slipper. My thought was, well, I imagine that the Jews of Europe, who were saved from genocide by war, might have a different perspective on that question, as mm-hmm. might the Kosovars, mm-hmm. As indeed might the population of the Falkland Islands, who, but for Britain's willingness to go to war, would now be ground underneath the heel of Argentina. But, you know, it's much easier to just say, I'm against war, I'm for peace, I'm against the bomb, than it is to address the complexity of the situation and to address what's on the other side of the ledger, particularly because what's on the other side of the ledger is always speculative. You know, you're always speculating, well, maybe the Japanese generals could have been talked into it, even though all the evidence suggests that what really changed was that the two atom bombs broke the resolve of the Emperor of Japan and gave him leverage against the generals,
mm-hmm.
who wanted to continue and would have, but for the Emperor having...
They would have absolutely continued. No doubt about it. So, my question for you is, do you think that dropping the bomb met the just war requirements? And if so, how?
Well, I'm not sure in the first instance if I agree with the premise that you apply the just war doctrine at the level of a battle rather than a war. Once a war has begun, does one then turn around and apply, assuming that it meets in the first place the
mm-hmm.
The requirements for the just war doctrine, do you then at each step turn around and say, Does the evacuation from Dunkirk meet the requirements of the Just War Doctrine? Does the Blitzkrieg meet the requirement? Does the bombing of Dresden meet it? Does so on and so forth? So I don't know that you would apply that doctrine at that level.
I think you have to.
Yeah.
If you're going to talk about just war, part of that is just means. And so you can look at something like the firebombing of Dresden, for example, you know, and ask.
Which, by the way, I'm not sure that I would have done.
Yeah, it was in many ways more horrifying than the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I understand that. So my question is, do you think the firebombing of Dresden was just means? And if not, then why not? And how does that relate to the atom bomb being dropped?
If you look at the casualties, fewer people died from a dropping of an atomic bomb than died in firebombings.
Even Tokyo.
More people died in the firebombing of Tokyo than died in the atomic bomb. You could make an argument, and it's a persuasive argument, that the cities were not legitimate military targets. And I'm willing to entertain that argument. But the dropping of the atomic bomb was a necessary step, and it saved us from an invasion of Japan, and it saved us from a Third World War.
That's the intimidating the Soviets, basically?
Well, not just... In a level, it intimidated the Soviets, but it intimidated both sides. If it was not for atomic weapons, we would have gone to war over Berlin.
Yeah.
If Stalin didn't know we had atomic weapons and were willing to use them, then he would have marched his forces into Berlin instead of trying to starve them out like he did. And whenever they moved to Berlin, we would have responded in force, and we would have had a third world war, which we may have not have won. And even if we did, it would have cost millions upon millions of lives. So this war is horrible, yes. But this focus on atomic weaponry is just technophobia. It's a technology, and it's horrible, and so therefore we have to oppose it. If you're going to oppose technology that kills people, then you should be smearing blood on bullet factories. Because bullets kill far more people than atomic weapons ever have, and probably ever will.
Landmines.
Yeah, they're landmines, or, you know, bombs, or any of these things. But no, it's atomic weapons, and it's atomic energy that gets all of the focus because it's new, scary technology with atoms and all of that. And it is massive and horrifying, but that horrifying technology kept us from the Third World War.
I suppose there is a cognizable difference in this particular context when we're talking about bombing Japan, because at that point it wasn't just a nuclear weapon, and mm-hmm. there isn't a calculus that you go through, does the other side have this weapon, and so on. It was a psychological effect that they were going for, and indeed obtained, on the Emperor, that here is this unbelievably powerful, crushing new technology. Because, you know, any idiot with a chip fryer could have burned down Tokyo, but the ability to destroy a single a city in a single instant was a new proposition that was a lot more dangerous. And of course, this is again another thing that is given short shrift by critics of it. But of course, Japan had no idea how many of these things we had, and the firebombing of Tokyo combined with the first couple of uses of the atom bomb, if you posit that you are the Emperor of Japan, you have just seen that your enemy is willing to wipe out entire cities, and indeed now has the means to do so, not by the comparatively crude method of burning it down, but essentially snapping one's fingers and the city just vanishes in a puff of smoke. And if you do not know that your enemy doesn't have an unlimited supply of these things, then it's not very wise to continue fighting. And so just that psychological effect, in this limited context, I think there is a difference between nukes and firebombings. psychological, if not technological.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which doesn't really answer your question about whether it's justified to do. I don't know off the top of my head what the justification for Dresden was. I would like to think that it was about more than just retaliation for Coventry, which would not be very attractive. But, you know, it goes back to the Iron Man argument that you posed on your blog earlier, that in contrast to the Straw Man argument, where someone substitutes a weaker argument for the argument being made, that sometimes you can substitute a stronger argument. And so I would hate to substitute for Dresden a stronger argument that, well, it was done for the same reason that we did the atom bombs. It was designed to inculcate fear in the German high command, that we could do this at will and indeed would do, and so on. I don't know whether that's actually the justification that they used, and I'd be kind of chary about attributing that to them. But, yeah, maybe.
Well, I can tell you that the bombing of Dresden and other cities, the British had a plan. Part of it was in retaliation for the bombing of London and these places. Part of it was also the idea, if we destroy these places, if we destroy entire cities, then it's going to break the Germans' will to fight. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't... Some places there was military justification for attacking the targets, and a lot of places like Dresden there wasn't. I know that with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was at least the window dressing of saying it was a military target. There was excuses that, they had factories in these locations, there were strategic units based out of these places, and so that's why it's a legitimate target.
Also, total war seems to present a different moral calculus to a different kind of military action. If you're in an existential struggle with an enemy that has force comparable to your own, such as the Allied powers against Nazi Germany and Japan, the Cold War, and so on, then that's one thing, and you can make a stronger argument for total war and for targeting civilian populations in this kinds of interim strategies than you could if the United States had gone into Iraq in 2003 and just bombed the hell out of civilian centers, because there was no question of who was going to prevail in in that fight. You know, we were going to win. They were going to be at best a distraction. So for us to have targeted civilian populations during that operation would have been a serious problem in a way that one could at least make an argument for it in the context of total war.
At the time of the Iraq War, did you favor it?
Targeting civilian populations or the war?
the war in general.
Okay, yes, I did. Not for any of the reasons that the Bush administration... Well, and that's not quite true.
The Bush administration proposed a lot of reasons.
Yes.
Take your pick.
Yes, they did. And one of the frustrations that I had with them at the time was that instead of saying, as was probably the truth, look, we have 9 reasons that cumulatively, when put together, add up to a good reason to do this, instead dripped out one at a time. Mm-hmm. And so it looked like a result in search of a reason. Because people are always looking for a slam dunk case rather than a persuasive case, because if it's merely persuasive, then people can disagree in good faith, and it's much harder to... you get into this complexity thing. I supported it because Saddam Hussein was a particularly vicious dictator, and the world would be, and indeed is, better off without him. Mm-hmm. Reason one. My other reason was because I foresaw that his regime was going away one way or another, and there was very little chance that it was going to fail safe. It was going to fail deadly. When he went, either was assassinated or died, his sons...
Uday and Qusay,
thank you, would either split or, you can imagine the kind of the scenarios playing out.
Right, they would have separate fiefdoms, potentially.
Yeah, right, but what I foresaw happening was this situation where the country splinters into a Saudi-affiliated Sunni South, a Shia, Iran-oriented East, and an independent Kurdistan in the north. Whereupon, of course, the Kurds in Turkey and Iran immediately declare their intention to join Kurdistan. Iran comes in to protect its religious kinsmen in the east. The Saudis, of course, can't have any of this tomfoolery going on, so they come in to support their religious kinsmen from the south. And suddenly you have extremely volatile situation with these large military powers who don't like each other very well, at one another's throats, in a context where you have Kurdistan in the middle of it overlapping with a NATO member, which may or may not take too kindly to these events. And then all of a sudden you have, I can't remember which article of the North Atlantic Treaty it is, but
Article 5,
thank you, you have an attack on the soil of Turkey, which is a NATO member, and therefore it is an attack on the soil of the United States. And are we now going to go to war over that in a way, in a situation where we're completely unprepared? And so it just seemed to me that this was a clusterfuck in the making.
So your fears, all way back then, that, what was, 10 years ago, is it now?
12.
Yeah. Is what's going to happen in about 6 months.
Yeah. That's why it was a horrible, horrible mistake to pull our troops out of Iraq. But yeah, that is almost exactly the scenario that I see playing out now, with the exception that the rise of ISIS has complicated matters significantly.
So, yeah, with the Iraq war, I would like to go on record and say I was a one-man counter-protest against the anti-war protest on the campus of ISU, and I had a John Lennon song sung at me, which was, you know...
Delightful.
It's always wonderful to have Imagine sung at you, and everyone point at you while they're singing certain verses. I was gleefully holding up my sign. So, yeah.
That's what college is all about, Mike.
I lost friends over that, and, it was my final divorce with the British left. That was the decree nisi. Because, of course, the question that they would ask, well, if Saddam Hussein, why not Robert Mugabe? To which my answer was, yes, why not? How about him next? Absolutely. In fact, we have the wherewithal to do that in an afternoon. Send in the SAS and let's get it done. Chop, chop. But they didn't like that answer.
Yeah. My answer to that would be Robert Mugabe that doesn't have and hasn't, to my knowledge, ever developed biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons. Knowing what we knew then, I would have gone into Iraq, and I think that we could have done a good job of it. I mean, the battle for Iraq against Iraqi forces was a stunning textbook victory beyond the wild imaginations of even the most proficient army in the history of civilization. Right. We do a horrible job at nation building because we're not horrible people. You have to be a horrible person to really be very, very effective at nation building.
Why is that, Mike?
Because you have to be willing to subjugate the population. And to subjugate the population, you have to be willing to play a long game, you have to be willing to execute people, and play favorites.
So Genghis Khan.
Yeah, Genghis Khan, the British...
Well, but look, we didn't do that in Germany.
We were wiped the map off of Germany. Germany.
I like that expression, we wiped the map off of it.
It got, you know, if we would have... If we would have bombed Iraq for 4 years, then yes, Iraqis would be a lot more complacent. But we didn't, because we're not horrible people.
Sure.
And so because...
Well, when?
Yeah, well, the other thing that you want to do if you're nation building is play favorites. You pick one tribe, and you appoint them to be in charge. And you give them the power. And we don't do that because that's a horrible thing to do. But that's what you do. That's what's been done. You look at Africa, you look at Asia, all of these places. Some colonial comes in and picks a minority group and says, congratulations, you guys are the rulers. And sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not. I mean, you want to say, oh, they're never successful. Look at Rwanda. But to that I say, look at Jordan. You have the Alawites in Jordan, and they've been very successful ruling a minority, ruling over a majority, because they're not evil. But it plays out like it plays out.
I think it's going to depend on the context. I mean, we've talked a lot about Afghanistan and the Bush administration's ideological refusal to appoint a king, even though that would probably have worked. Well, in that kind of context, you're not subjugating one group, and I think that you and I have agreed, maybe Sam and I have agreed, that approach would have been the most effective way to handle Afghanistan.
Yes.
Now, obviously, that entirely depends on the conditions of the ground. There was no king of Iraq.
Yes.
I mean, so for example, if military action in Iran becomes necessary, the logical thing to do once we've crushed them into the ground, because their military will last about 20 minutes, would be to bring back the Shah.
Provided that the Shah still has legitimacy there. I don't know, because the Iranian people tend to be pretty secular.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly don't know that there is even a living descendant of the last Shah. But it just seems like...
We can find a cousin somewhere.
Sure. I mean, but you want to find something that becomes a common rallying point for everyone, if there is such a thing. Now, in some cases, there just isn't.
I mean...
In Iraq, there really isn't.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, if I was to go into Iran and take it over, I'd find some minor religious leader and have him be a minor focal point, which would be very ironic.
Which minor religion?
Islam.
Which branch of Islam are you talking about? Tell me you're not going to do another Salafist.
Why would you replace an Ayatollah with another Ayatollah? What?
Because it seems to work. I don't know. It's, as you said, a common rallying point. And
if you can find someone who's not nuts.
Exactly. If you can find someone who's moderate, who says maybe we shouldn't chop the heads off of everybody, or maybe if a woman's raped, she doesn't deserve to be stoned. You know, crazy ideas over here.
It's just nutty.
Maybe... Someone like that as a common rallying point.
We talked out about war. Anyone got any more on that?
No, I think we talked out with the war.
Cool. Let's get topical.
Yeah.
You want to talk about the is her name Kim Davis? Is that
yes?
Name?
Kim Davis.
Okay. Kim Davis.
Okay.
County clerk of recent fame.
Yeah,
I say this is an international podcast, and so we should probably explain what's going on. And who she is. I mean, everyone in America, I think, is kind of au fait on this.
It's clearly where the country revolves around this county in Kentucky.
Nay, the world.
In the middle of clearly the focal point, what's on everyone's mind and should be, is whether or not a clerk in Kentucky will issue marriage license.
So the story is that after Obergefell required, in effect, that any state that issues marriage licenses to heterosexual couples also issue them to homosexual couples, this woman, who I believe is a born-again Christian and a Democrat, interestingly enough, said that she has to sign as part of her job these marriage licenses saying something to the effect of that I recognize that these people are married. And because she doesn't believe that they can do any such thing, she's refusing to issue licenses. There's a point I'm unclear on. It's in the R.R. Reno story that underlies the Ed Peters piece that you had put in the show notes. I'm not clear on whether she is refusing to issue any marriage licenses, or if she's only refusing to issue the ones that she disapproves of.
It's so, specifically to same-sex couples.
Well, see, Reno says that precisely in order to not discriminate, she's actually not issuing them to anyone.
Well, then that's new, because initially it started
with... I've not heard this.
Initially it started with a refusal to issue it to same-sex couples.
Right.
And her approach was to avoid it, if possible. by indicating that the office was closed.
About for lunch. So,
right.
Yeah.
Precisely that sort of, oh, I've stepped away for a moment.
Not here. I'm sick.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sick. Yeah. And...
It's funny if she wore comical disguises around the office as so not to grin, like she had a top hat and monocle.
Yes, clearly this is how you handle things. No, I admire her courage in being willing to go to jail for this.
Yes, it's a wonderful witness, regardless of anything else.
Right, I admire her courage. Unfortunately, that courage came after some not-so-courageous things. And there was an unfortunate contrast there. Between those two kinds of ways of handling it.
What do you have in mind?
I think a more courageous way of doing it would have been to simply outright refuse the first time, instead of trying to avoid the issue. My guess is that she was trying not to offend the couple.
Right, it seems like that's an attempt to be tactful.
Right, she was probably trying not to offend the couple, which makes sense. Because we have a culture in which it is totally inappropriate to give offense to people. And unfortunately, that kind of gave the impression that she was wishy-washy on the subject. Mm. And then later decided, I'm going to stand firm on this. And I think it would have served her better to stand firm on it from the beginning. And that's despite the fact that I disagree with her choice. Mm. I would have certainly admired her more had she stood firm on it from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to the disagreeing with her on that, but I have a stipulation that I think is important to discuss in this, which is that I think that bringing Obergefell into this discussion is a distraction. And of course everyone wants to talk about it, but again, it's the Iron Man defense, because Kim Davis's point is not that she disagrees with the Obergefell decision as a matter of law, or legal process or anything like that. She would be in exactly the same position, and we would be in exactly the same position, had the state of Kentucky amended its constitution legitimately to provide for same-sex marriage, had a federal constitutional amendment been ratified. And so really talking about how it came to be that she is now in a position where she has to issue these licenses because of a change in the law, it's really incredibly irrelevant how it is that that change in the law came about. And of course I understand why people want to talk about it, because the decision is a huge problem and desperately wrong. And of course it's fun to talk about that and to bash the Supreme Court, because we're just used to doing that. It's an easy rhetorical default. But I don't think that it actually has an awful lot to do with this. The same result would apply no matter how we got here.
It's a case of people equating different things and not really thinking through the differences. Everyone's thinking that this is the same thing as those poor bakers being persecuted for not baking a gay cake and all those similarities going on there. They're not thinking through the idea that, you know, you don't have the same personal rights whenever you're acting as a representative of the state.
Yes.
You know, this isn't about her personal preferences. This is about her carrying out the laws of the state of Kentucky and the United States of America. You know, in times like these, I ask myself, what would St. Thomas More do? And of course, we know what he did. Whenever he was not able out to carry his duties as Chancellor of England because of the desires of his king, he stood down. He gave up the chancellorship and went into private life where he could, or he believed he could, carry out his personal objections privately. Now, I'm not saying that she needs to be quiet about her beliefs. No, she's not afraid of being executed publicly.
Yes.
But yes, yet. But she should resign. That's where your duty lies, to uphold the rule of law. You know, a lot of people aren't thinking this through. If a Muslim was the head of the liquor license in the local county and refused to issue liquor licenses because he was a Muslim, then we would tell him he needed to step down, not applaud him for upholding his religious beliefs.
I mean, there, in a certain sense, there is no state.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The state is an intellectual construct, and a legal construct. And so, because the state only acts through instrumentalities, humans, elected officials, appointed
mm-hmm.
officials, staff, and so forth, to say the state cannot do X is to say that the people who act for the state are not able to do X, even if they might personally feel differently about it. And so, you know, the analogy that I've proposed to people is, well, you know, imagine you're pulled over by, I hate to drag the Supreme Court back into this, having just discharged them from the case, but the but you know, imagine you are pulled over by a cop, and he's arresting you, and you say, well, what about my Miranda rights? And the cop says, nope, we don't follow Miranda in this state.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter what your personal opinion of Miranda is, and it doesn't matter, you know, how it came to be. You don't get to make that decision. The state is required to read you your rights. Therefore, the cop is required to read you your rights because he's functioning as an
mm-hmm.
instrumentality
yep.
Of the state. There's a whole branch of 14th Amendment law governing when you can sue a private company under the 14th Amendment, which is kind of an eyebrow-raising notion, because in certain capacities, private contractors are acting as an actor, as a state actor,
mm-hmm.
And therefore they are functionally the state, and it's much the same thing here. You also mentioned the public-private distinction, which, I think is something that is getting... it's overplayed. The difference, it seems to me, is that if I go up to the Covered Bridge Festival and I'm wearing my Carly for President t-shirt and the funnel cake vendor says, I'm sorry, we don't serve your kind here, or if I'm black, or if I'm wearing a rosary beads or what have you, some identifiable thing that causes someone to discriminate against me, my remedy is that I go huffily to the funnel cake vendor immediately next door. And I get my funnel cake, and life goes on. And what happens, in effect, is that the market drives out discrimination, because discrimination is inefficient. If you have a seller who will not sell to group X, then either the sellers who will sell to group X will do better. They'll prosper because they are less discriminating in who they'll sell to, so they'll just rake in more money. Or if there is no one, then that becomes a business opportunity. So if there is no funnel cake vendor who will sell to Catholics, that's a signal for a Catholic who knows how to make funnel cake to go and make money hand over fist at the Covered Bridge Festival, and so the need will be supplied. Where it's different with government is that there is only one government per polity, right? You know, you have your choice of funnel cake vendors, but you have to deal with the government, the same government, no matter what. And it just doesn't seem convincing to me to say, as some people have said, well, you could just go to the next county across or to the different office. I have some doubts about whether that's true in any practical sense. I don't know that I can go to any DMV in the state of Indiana as a resident of this county and obtain a driver's license. I don't know that that's true. Maybe it's true on the level that I could go to a different city. But even if it is true, I have a real problem with the idea that even though I'm entitled to receive something from the state, that I am not able to obtain that from any qualified state office.
So essentially what you're saying here is that the problem is that the state has a monopoly.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, in that kind of context. And that's when we tend to think that regulation is appropriate, right? Government is properly intervenes in the market in situations when the market can't itself correct for various distortions. And in the case of discrimination, the market usually can compensate for that, as I was just outlining. But yes, oddly enough, the government has a monopoly on government. By the way, if Reno is right that she isn't discriminating because she's not issuing any marriage permits... I mean,
well, if she stopped issuing other marriage permits,
right. Then
what remains is the problem of her not fulfilling her duties.
Right, and I was going to say, so imagine that you have a clerk who was charged with issuing concealed carry permits. Mm-hmm. And after the Heller decision, he turns around, or she turns around, and says, it's just too darn dangerous now, so I'm just going to refuse to issue permits. Even though he doesn't actually have any discretionary authority to turn them down, he just says, well, I'm not going to give them to anyone. And that person's not discriminating. But I think that you'd probably still sue the hell out of the county.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that situation.
I certainly would. And if it was an open carry state, I'd say, fine. Yeah. I'll just slap it on my hip.
Right.
Kind of off of her and the marriage license, did you hear about the idiotic court judge who refused to issue a divorce because of the Obergefell's decision?
No, what happened?
Apparently, as an idiotic form of political protest, a couple came before him, regular heterosexual couple, came before him and said, we want a no-fault divorce. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't issue that to you guys, because the courts have changed marriage so significantly that I'm not sure what the definition of marriage is, and so I need further instruction from the Supreme Court on what exactly marriage is before I can issue you the divorce.
That's a premium quality cert paper right there.
Not. Yeah, I can
we get
imagine.
A circuit split on... Actually, we might get a circuit split on this question. Don't see them taking the case.
I can imagine even Antonin Scalia looking at that and just putting his palm slowly in his face.
Yeah.
Oh, I so need a Justice Scalia face palm image. You know, that would solve. I resort to the Captain Picard face palm because it's almost as good. But
what makes it particularly horrible? I can't remember which state this was in, but according to state law, the court case has to be held in the county where the defendant resides. They can't go to another county
Sure. In
order to get the divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the judge for that county.
Well, and that's,
they can't get the divorce.
Yeah, and you'd stepped out for a moment, but that was kind of what I was talking about with regard to the monopoly piece on the government.
Mm-hmm.
With a private seller, of course, you can just go to a different private seller. But one response that I've seen to the idea that you just go to the next county across if the clerk in county A denies you your license, you just go to county B. But you, as a practical matter, quite aside from anything else, you can't always do that.
So do you guys think that Catholics and other Christians are going to have to withdraw from public office such as this?
This would be a good moment to return to where Sam left off about whether he would have signed the marriage license. We put a pin in that earlier, and for once, we're actually going to come back to it.
Yeah. And I honestly don't have an answer to that question. I decided a long time ago that I'm not suitable for elected office, like most elected officials. And unlike most elected officials, I won't bother pursuing it. So I'll probably never have to face that problem. But it's an interesting theoretical question, at least. So let's suppose that in some other... of all the possible worlds, that I decided that it was a good idea, because I was even more stupid in that world than I am in this one, to seek elected office. In that particular case, I actually don't think I would have a problem signing the marriage license. And the reason for that is that, assuming that all other things are equal, I am under no illusion that the state's understanding of marriage has anything to do with the church's understanding of marriage. It's...
Say, you present the same question if you have someone who you knew to be divorced, who had not
received
an annulment, who was now seeking a second marriage.
Yes,
you'd be in the same quandary.
Right, as a Catholic, if I were to be consistent about it, if, for example, I were to say, I can't sign the marriage license if this person is going to be in mortal sin... then I would have to stop signing probably a good 30 to 40% of marriage licenses.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, can I do that? And the reason I don't have an issue with it is because I'm well aware that the state's definition of marriage has absolutely nothing to do
with our definition of marriage, except in the sense that historically they have operated concurrently.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They're sort of like two concurrent prison sentences.
A lot of married men will agree with you.
Right. I'm single, but I thought married men might appreciate the analogy.
Yeah, I'd have
I
to say...
Good choice.
I'd have to say on the will you, if you'd sign the marriage license question, if you get out the, you know, material support of evil flowchart... And there are, and it's actually quite useful, because there's other places where people can go, and it's quite clear that you're acting as an instrument of the state and not giving your personal approval. Then I think it is allowable for a Catholic to work in a clerk's office for the city, signing marriage licenses. Mm-hmm. You know, what's not acceptable is if a Catholic founds a company that caters to gay weddings. I think that would be something that would
right.
cross the line.
Right. That would be a very different kind of category.
Yeah.
I tend to think of it very much in category terms, both in terms of my obligations as both a Catholic and a context-dependent piece about what kind of role it is. I'd almost want to split the baby, because I don't think that a legislator is in the same position as an executive branch officer,
mm-hmm.
Or indeed a judicial officer. If I am a member of the Indiana legislature, I would quite happily vote for a bill at odds with Roe against Wade, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a sheriff, an elected official, an executive official in Indiana, we should say, I would not stand outside of Planned Parenthood trying to prosecute women who had just had an abortion, because that would be silly. You're in a different position as a legislator than you are in an executive branch official, because again, the executive branch is the state. That is the state acting, and the states are regulated by the Constitution in a way that I don't think that legislatures are. The legislature is the body that makes the laws for the state. It is not itself an instrumentality of the state, which I realize is kind of dicey as a question of constitutional law, but as an intellectual construct to try and explain the difference and why it's not the same, I think it's somewhat helpful. I would also think of it in terms of categories and of discretionary authority against ministerial. Justice Scalia has a famous article that is now doing the rounds again because it is noted that it bears a distinct resemblance to the Kim Davis situation, in which he indicated that if he believed that Evangeline Vito was correct about the death penalty, then he would have to resign from the Supreme Court, because he would then be tinkering with the machinery of death, which is a phrase from one of Justice Blackmun's opinions. And I think he's wrong about that. I understand the application of it to the Kim Davis piece, but I think that if I were a trial judge vested with discretion to give someone a sentence, I would not be able to impose a death sentence as a member of the Catholic Church, the Catholic faith. And if I were required by a statute to impose a mandatory death sentence, which used to occur, no longer does, because in the 70s the Supreme Court said mandatory death penalty, no good, then in that situation I would have to resign. Because then I would have, in some sense, be in a discretionary role where my discretion allows only one outcome, and it's an outcome that I can't do, and so I would have to resign. But I don't think that an appellate judge or a prison warden are in those kinds of situations. So, for example, I've argued that as a governor, I couldn't sign death sentences, because that to me seems discretionary, not ministerial. But then again, there are other positions within the system which are not discretionary in any way, shape, or form. They're just ministerial. the clerk's role seems to me to be essentially the same thing. Mm-hmm. The clerk isn't being asked for her opinion on the public policy of the Commonwealth of Kentucky or the state of Indiana or what have you. She's not being asked whether, you know, these people should be married, these people specifically, or as members of a class. She has a purely ministerial role that, quite frankly, could be replaced with a touchscreen kiosk, as will probably happen in a few short years and as happens now in some McDonald's in Europe. I mean, she's essentially just a cog in the machine, mm-hmm. and the cogs don't get to vote. They get to vote in their capacity as a private citizen, but they don't get to vote in their capacity as a cog. Their job is to just go round and round. And so, yeah, I would not necessarily have a problem signing that certificate, but if I did, in that situation, and you have an attack of conscience, and you think to yourself, well, boy, I just can't do this, then the honourable way ahead is, as others have said, to resign. That's what you do. That's what Moore did. It's what Scalia says he would do in that situation. And again, I disagree that he would need to, but that's the force of his reasoning. And the reasoning makes sense on the stipulations of that he makes. So
this sounds completely different from anybody else's opinion on the Kim Davis case that I've heard. Mm-hmm. Most of what I've heard has been along the lines of, you know, wonderful, you know, she's standing up for her beliefs, she's being attacked for her religious beliefs.
Which I appreciate, by the way. I mean, it's a good witness.
Or on the contrary, this is terrible, she's an asshole, why is she doing this?
I've seen a lot of people gloating that she's in jail. Yeah. Which I think, I've seen some prison rape jokes.
Okay, so let's finish up and move on to lighter fare and talk about the haircut.
Yes.
It's the Donald.
Oh, I thought you had noticed that I got a haircut.
Well, look, here's the thing. I really want to believe that we have reached peak Trump, which is what I've really wanted to believe for a long time.
Yeah.
And so what I want to hope is that now is our time to talk about Trump, because if we don't talk about him now, he's going to have disappeared in the rearview mirror, and no one will remember who the fatuous oaf is, and it will become entirely untopical to talk about him.
You're such an optimist. That's
I really am.
Right. Yeah.
Bill Kristol said the other day on the Weekly Standard podcast that he has been consistently wrong about Trump disappearing from the scene for the last month or so.
Yeah.
But now he thinks maybe we really have reached peak Trump. And I'm going to join him in his optimism and his perpetually being wrong about it.
We will not reach peak Trump until the votes are cast. Whenever he loses that first primary or caucus.
Now who's the optimist?
And, well, no, a lot of people are saying that he's going to drop out before. A lot of people have been saying he's going to drop out before the votes are cast. But I think once people realize, oh, everyone else is saying we're going to vote for him, but no one actually is, that's whenever the air comes out of this big bloviated mass we call Trump.
See, the problem is that the Ricochet podcast was talking about this earlier this week, and they mm-hmm. said that if you look at how Trump is behaving now, he seems to be running for president.
Mm-hmm.
Which
yes.
seems like, you know, it should be the most obvious thing in the world, but, you know, they posit he got into it on a lark,
mm-hmm.
and it was all a lot of fun and games, and he, self-publicity, that kind of stuff, long commercial for The Apprentice season 52 or whatever we're up to now, and somewhere along the way, he suddenly got it into his head, oh, people seem to be supporting me. I could potentially be president of the United States.
It was,
and so now he's running, and he actually sees himself as running for president.
It was whenever the moment was, whenever he made that remarks about the Mexicans, the horrible offensive remarks about the Mexicans, and Macy's and other people started pulling sponsorships. That's the moment whenever Trump decided, okay, I'm in. I'm going to show these SOBs. I'm going to show these people who aren't taking me serious because I'm tired of not being taken serious. And in all fairness, he's showing a lot of people. What he's showing us is horrifying, but he's showing a lot of people that, you know, populism is popular.
And
Go figure.
Well, I think a lot of his supporters, that's one of the things that they like about him, that they would like to say the same thing, that they're tired of not being taken seriously, and they're tired of no one listening to them, which I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And they're tired of the Republican establishment being a total waste of time, which I agree with. And they take a certain visceral thrill in seeing someone standing up and saying things that we, big scare quotes, aren't allowed to say, even bigger scare quotes, and saying them anyway, and no one can say or do anything about it. And I understand and appreciate that, too. I can buy all of the diagnosis. What I don't buy is the cure. Several people have suggested recently, Crystal's again one of them, and there have been several others, that this is now a cultural identity thing. This is a total identity politics thing, that if you're pissed off and fed up with the current state of America, if you really want to stick it to the man, in this case the man being defined as the Republican establishment, whatever that may be, the way to externalize that hostility is by supporting this buffoon and saying things like, well, it doesn't matter. Ideas don't matter. It doesn't matter what he actually believes. What matters is that he shows the right cultural markers, which, again, is what marks it as identity politics rather than as anything I would recognize as movement conservatism or republicanism or anything that I thought that we were standing for. And when even Ann Coulter is selling out, then, boy, we're just in trouble.
You know, I think a lot of the media, and I consider Ann Coulter is part of the media. I'm sorry, Ann Coulter. The right-wing media is supporting Trump because he gets the headlines. And they want to see the headlines continue.
Well, and because the right-wing media has, for some time now, been very Trumpified. I mean, you know, we really deserve better than we have, but right-wing media to me is almost unreadable. It's just awful. Even though, in terms of actual political affiliation, I'm more or less with them on every point. There's something about the tone of it and the approach. We have something in the show notes for another thing that about my inexhaustible frustration with these things and just the quality of the what passes for journalism in the right-leaning media markets is just atrocious. And yes, Trump is simply feeding to the base the same kinds of things that you have seen for a long time. That kind of hysterical, thinly informed stuff that he is now trumping. Ha-ha. Mm.
I guess that's the danger whenever your movement starts to align with populists.
Yes.
The conservative movement in the United States used to be a minority. I mean, we all remember reading about the days whenever conservatism was this weird concept coming out of this small part of the northeast of the United States.
Right, the National Review.
Yeah,
so.
National Review, this guy who speaks in a big British accent. But all of a sudden, you know, if you look at it historically, whenever in the 1990s, whenever we won the majority and we have the Blue Dog Southern Democrats jumping on board because the Democratic Party had left them, that's the moment that we became a populist movement. And while we've had success with it in terms of elections, unfortunately, intellectually, we've suffered because of it. And populist movements want to see results. We want things get done, and we don't care how they get done. And that's not what conservatism is. A democratic form of government, you're always going to have populists. And the question is what to do about it. And if watching the monstrosity called the French Revolution has taught us anything, it's to keep those populists in check. Because populists very quickly become radicals.
And radicals very quickly become tyrants.
Yes, and then they lose their heads.
But, you know, there's it's hard to see a cure, because the reason that they are frustrated at the Republican establishment is that the Republican establishment hasn't done anything, which is somewhat different to the reason why I share their contempt for the Republican establishment, which is simply that I don't fault them for not having accomplished anything. I fault them for not having tried.
Mm-hmm.
The Trumpkins fault them for not having accomplished anything, seemingly oblivious to the actual business of how politics works.
Yeah.
And that you can't actually do a lot of these things that you want to do. And one concrete example might be, well, why haven't they defunded Obama over the, well, anything, really? Well, the reason is because for many years now we have been in this business of these monstrosities, the omnibus spending bills, where everything gets jammed into a single bill that passes or not. And that turns out to be a vehicle that transfers power to the presidency, because then you can't dare defund any specific agency, because the result will be that you'll defund everything, there'll be a government shutdown, and the Democrats will win the air war. And Mitch McConnell, who may be a coward but is no dummy, is fully aware of that, and so doesn't mm-hmm. want to do that. But then that doesn't placate the populace. And if there's no way to actually move forward and accomplish something, if, God help us, Hillary Clinton should be the next president, this isn't going to go away. It's just going to, the heat is just going to simmer ever hotter. Now, of course, if someone on the Republican side wins and progress is made, then that deflates it. Maybe that turns down the heat. But there's a third and yet worse scenario, which is that a Republican president is elected, quite possibly Donald Trump, and can't get anything done because either the Republicans in Congress are useless or they find themselves at loggerheads. And then even though we control all the branches of government, still nothing happens, and that will make the Trumpkins even angrier. That's your French Revolution point, I think. That's the point at which people start to say, well, what's the point in any of this? It's time to secede.
Yeah. A basic understanding of civics and the history of the United States will get these people far. Unfortunately, it's lacking. You can't get anything done in Congress unless you have a veto-proof majority in the Senate. We don't have that. So we're not the only thing the Senate, and all of our Republican representatives in the House and the Senate is good for, is to obstruct.
Which is a valuable thing. I had a post about this earlier in the week, that what they are missing, and again, this kind of comes back to the problem of talking about war, that the benefits are kind of speculative, that even if you take the view that the Republicans in Congress have accomplished absolutely nothing for us, what they have succeeded wildly in accomplishing is preventing a Democratic majority and Barack Obama from passing all sorts of stuff that we would absolutely detest. If you thought Obamacare was bad, imagine what he was going to do next had he been able to retain that majority. And all of that agenda has been, at worst, been on ice for now a number of years. I think we're all running down a little bit. We might want to call it a day and turn the air conditioning back on. You're looking a little red in the face. For a Texan, you seem very red in the face at not too warm a temperature.
Well, I'm used to the temperature being rather lower in here.
Okay. Well, we'll wrap it up here then. Hopefully by the time we next talk, Donald Trump will be in the rearview mirror.
Next year in Jerusalem.